your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Shall call. Live you must, and let to live. Fairly take, and fairly give. Do what thou will, if it harms none. By the magic of all, may it be done. 9 woods in the cauldron go, as above, so below. Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. The opening music tonight was called Masquerade of the Ghosts, and with Samhain, Halloween, just a week away, ghosts and spirits are on everybody's minds, and hopefully the spirits of our ancestors as well, because this is the time of year where we revere the ancestors, we walk with them, with the ancients, and try to contact them as well. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight with my guest, Ellen Everett Hopman. Now, she's a master herbologist and a lay homeopath who has been a dryadic initiate since 1984. She's a founding member of the Order of the White Oak and Archdruidess of the Tribe of the Oak, a former professor at the Grey School of Wizardry, and a member of the Grey School Council of Mages and Sages. She's the author of several books, including Secret Medicines from Your Garden, and the book we'll be talking about tonight, The Sacred Herbs of Samhain, Plants to Contact the Spirits of the Dead. So thank you for joining me tonight, Ellen, and welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. I'm here in New England, and the leaves are still incredibly colorful. You know, the maples are bright red, and the oaks are golden, and It's just the most beautiful time of year.
See, I envy that in a way, because palm trees don't change color. And, you know, we don't have, I mean, every so often you'll find a tree that kind of gets that reddish tinge to it, but not often enough. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, I mean, it's 98 degrees here today. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah, well, that's why the fires are burning so well, and no humidity. But I guess, you know, I've lived here all my life, so I'm not used to four seasons anyway. I don't think I would recognize one if it changed. So it's just like here we have, you know, you lived here, you know, it's either warm or warmer, cool or cooler. It's no snow, well, up in the mountains. So yeah, it's kind of a nice thing to think about that people actually have autumn, because I saw this thing on Facebook the other day and somebody wrote, my favorite color is October. And that's so right. Yeah.
I totally get that.
Yeah, I do too. From afar.
In front of my door right now, I have two pumpkins, bright orange. I have rust-colored asters in a big pot, and then I have blood-red asters in a big pot. And then on the ground, there's yellow leaves, red leaves, golden leaves, green leaves. You know, it's the most colorful time of year, really, for us.
Oh, you just brought a tear to my eye, and now I'm jealous. Somebody actually took pity on me several years ago when I said I'd never seen autumn leaves, and they put a whole bunch of them in an envelope and sent them to me.
Oh, I could have done that. It's probably too late now, but
yeah.
If you remind me next year, I'll send you a box of leaves.
Oh, okay, good. Do they smell good? I forget. Do they have an autumn leaves?
No, not really. No? They're not flowers.
Well, no, but you know, leaves have a certain... Like if you're,
yeah, they smell like leaves.
Yeah, okay. I just didn't know if they had an autumn smell or something.
Well, California, you have gorgeous leaves. You have bay laurel.
Yes, we do.
You have rosemary. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything like that, see?
You don't, huh?
No.
All right. So we're lucky in some respects.
Yeah, you have the smells. We have the colors.
And join them together, and what have you got? Yay! that means we have to meet in the Midwest somewhere, right? Well, no, the Midwest probably has autumn stuff, too. Anyway, you know, I always, this time of year, I talk about ancestor veneration. I talk about building an altar. I talk about ancestor altar, making offerings to them, and ways of communicating with spirits. And, you know, I think that Sacred Herbs of Samhain is a wonderful guide to the magical herbs of the Sabbat for divination, for protection, and as tools for contacting spirits. But the other thing you do in this book is like, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you share traditions, you share rites and lores and history of Samhain and all kinds of things, recipes, all that good stuff. And I just want you to know, I really enjoyed the book, and I mean, I didn't read it cover to cover. I read it skim to skim, and things jumped out at me, and I'm like, oh God, I got to have some time to sit down and read this cover to cover. So thank you for writing a book like that, because it's really good.
Oh, well, thank you. I think of it as a reference book. I mean, you could read it cover to cover, but it's also the kind of book that you can turn to all year.
Yes.
Because, you know, for magical information about particular plants and how to communicate with spirits and how to do, I mean, I'm a druid, and I'm still trying to come up with a term for druids in the kitchen, but there's kitchen witchery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, using the magical plants, I try to give recipes for each plant so that once you do know the magical properties, you can work with the spirit of the plant, and you can work it into your meals, you know.
Yeah, just don't call it druid drudgery. That wouldn't be good.
No, that would be terrible.
That would be terrible, and that's what popped into my head, and I slapped myself I thought that. That was terrible. All right.
No.
well, you know what? I think there are probably some people listening that don't know about Samhain, and others that think maybe Samhain is just a different name for Halloween. So if you wouldn't mind, take a minute or two and explain Samhain, and then we'll jump deep into the book.
Okay, well, the way I think of it, and I'm sure there other people have other ideas, but I think of Halloween as a Christianized and now commercialized holiday, because I think they sell more candy at Halloween than any other time of year. So that means that, you know, the general public is observing this particular holiday, and kids get dressed up, and, you know, the Christian church took it over from Samhain, but it's not Samhain. Samhain is the original sacred holiday that they took, and it morphed into what we have now, which is orgies of candy and people dressing in costumes, you know. But there was some dressing in costumes, but the reason that you dressed in a costume was so that the spirits wouldn't recognize you, because it was very dangerous to be outside of the house after dark on Samhain. That was a really tricky thing to do. So you better put on a disguise, because just because people were dead doesn't mean they're nice. And if there's anybody dead who's mad at you, you don't want them to recognize you, you know, kind of thing. But Samhain, in the profound kind of religious sense, in the Celtic sense, Samhain is the beginning of the dark half of the year. There are only two seasons in Celtic thinking. You had the dark half, which was winter, the beginning of the year, and then you had the light half, which was summer, and that was it. They had summer and winter. And Samhain is a portal between the end of the light half and the beginning of the dark half. And then Beltane, and I have another book coming out, by the way, in April 2020 called The Sacred Herbs of Beltane.
So, I know, I saw that. I can't wait.
Yeah. But that Beltane is the portal between the end of the dark half of the year and the beginning of the light half of the year. And in ancient times, Beltane or Bealtaine was just as spiritual a night as Samhain. They were opposite sides of the year, but they're both portals. They're both times when the walls between the worlds are thin, when the ancestors can more easily cross over to us, when we can more easily cross to the other world. Our culture has embraced Halloween because of the costumes and the candy, and our culture now ignores Beltane or May Day. I'm old enough to remember when I was a little girl, when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, in public schools they were still celebrating May Day. It was a national holiday. And what happened was, because the Russians always had their big May Day parade on May 1st, the government actually put a stop to it. The government sent out this edict that nobody was to celebrate anything on May 1st. And that kind of ended it. But I remember when I was 5 or 6 years old that we would make May baskets. We did that in the regular public school. Mm-hmm. We made May baskets, and we were told to hang it on somebody's door, you know, on a doorknob of somebody that you didn't know. Just randomly go out and hang the basket on their door. And that was a very cute and charming thing to do. Of course, in those days, we also walked to school. Without adults, by the way. In first grade, I was already walking to school, and that was normal. Mm-hmm. These days, if somebody did that, they would be accused of child abuse, I think. But, you know, it was a really different world. So I remember walking down the street, finding a house that had nice flowers in front of it, and walking up to the door and hanging my May basket, you know. So anyway, there are a lot of traditions with, when you get into May Day, that are just as spiritual as anything you find at Samhain. For example, if you want to see the fairies, or if you want to see the elves or spirits, you sleep under a blooming hawthorn tree or a blooming elder, you know, and that helps you get to the other world. So people who like to think of the ancestors at Samhain should think of May Day or Bealtaine, Beltane, in the same way, that you can also communicate, you know, through the veil at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, this time of year, people are busy scurrying around, gathering all sorts of divination information in regards to contacting spirits. And we commonly hear about scrying or talking boards or pendulum and the like. But, you know, if I were a spirit, I think connecting with nature would draw me closer than man-made tools. And I'm pretty sure that using nature's gifts as offerings rather than plastic pumpkins would get my attention a lot quicker. So why is it so important, people will ask, to take the time to acknowledge those on the other side and try to get in contact with them this time of year?
Well, they're a part of us. We're not separate from them. Again, we live in a culture where you're not supposed to talk about death. It's not polite. You're allowed to mourn briefly at a funeral, and then after that you're just supposed to get over it or hide it. You know, it's weird. And just because somebody's dead doesn't mean that they're no longer here and they're no longer connected to us. And the way it's been described to me is that all of our ancestors going back and back and back, grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, all the way back, I like to say all the way back to blue-green algae, who I think of as my grandmother. it's like a snake. And you know how snakes have all these ribs?
Mm-hmm.
Every ancestor is like a bone in the back of the snake. We are the mouth of the snake. We're the only part of the snake that can communicate with the world. Mm-hmm. So if the ancestors want to speak or if they want to do anything in the world, it's up to us. We are their voice. We are their hands because they can't physically do it anymore. So it's really important to have a deep relationship with your ancestors, and you will be an ancestor one day too.
Mm-hmm.
But just know that you've got, you know, humans have been around for, you know, 4 million years in one form or another. You've mm-hmm. got millions of years of ancestors behind you.
Yeah.
They're all standing behind you, and they all have opinions, and they all have wisdom because they survived, or you wouldn't be here today. And mm-hmm. you can listen to them, and they can help you, and then you can help them because they have things they need to do in the world, and you can help them.
Yeah, and I think, again, going the botanical way is so much more natural than, you know, something that's man-made. I mean, not to say that that might not work if you're, you know, leaving offerings or something to entice somebody. But, you know, just I think, too, though, that there are a lot of people who were not drawn to nature in their lifetimes. And I'm wondering, and, you know, it's a rhetorical question, but if people that have been here and were not into nature and all that stuff, once they get on the other side, I wonder if they learn to appreciate it more and that causes a better bond between us and them. Any thoughts?
You're saying if they had no relationship with nature before they died? Is that
mm-hmm.
what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Goodness.
Well, there are people like that. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, but that's got to be a very recent thing because throughout history,
yes.
Everybody was close to nature with very few exceptions. You know,
yeah.
Most people were farmers, and before that they were hunter-gatherers for millions mm-hmm. of years. So to not be connected to nature is a very strange, rare, and peculiar thing. And that's another problem with our current mess that we're in with the world is because we're living in this really unnatural state where a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us are divorced from nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I've even seen articles about this that kids are suffering because they have a nature deficit.
Yeah.
So if kids are anxious or depressed, you put them out in nature and it cures them because, you know, that's where we're supposed to be. We're animals. You know, we belong, especially in forests, that mm-hmm. we're forest animals, you know. That's
yeah.
where we should be. And everybody feels better when they go into a forest. People calm down, you know.
They should. But, you know, you hear people also say, oh, no, there's bugs out there. There's, you know, it's dirty. It's, give me a hotel room that's fancy and, you know, or whatever.
That's the way they were raised.
Yeah.
That's very sad.
Yeah.
It's a sad thing.
I think everybody should just, you know, if you have a forest, if you have anywhere similar like that around, just go out there or just go into somebody's overgrown yard for example. I mean, with their permission, of course, because it's I can't explain what it feels like, but it really is good. It really kind of charges you up and grounds you in a way.
Well, I think because it makes you realize you're not just wrapped up with yourself. You realize that you're part of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that relaxes us because we're not, you know, if we're just thinking about ourselves and we're only in our head all the time, you know, that's a very scary place to be, you know, because mm-hmm. you're trying to be in control of everything. But when you get out in nature, you realize there's just so much more going on and you're just a tiny little part of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I just wish, you know, we could, like, let everybody that's listening to this and doesn't know that feeling, I wish we could just, like, put it in them just so they could get a feeling for, like, 2 seconds and go, oh, that's what they're talking about. Oh, this is good, you know. Maybe in the next lifetime, technology will be better and we can do that. But, you know, I think personally I would be like a benevolent spirit, but in the Celtic tradition, Samhain is also a time for those spirits, and you mentioned this before, who still have a bone to pick. They come back to settle a score. And the first part of the book talks about the herbs of the spirits and the dead and how to use them at Samhain like herbs for protection. What are some of the most common used for protection?
Well, poplar buds. I don't know if you have these trees in California. Do you have poplar?
No, I don't think we have poplar.
Well, yeah. Aspen poplar you would find, you know, in the Rocky Mountains, I guess. But we have them here. But you grind up poplar buds with pine resin and rosemary. You certainly have rosemary.
Yes.
And you make a natural incense out of that, and that wards off negative energies. And by the way, if you're going to do a ritual to contact the ancestors and the dead, there's three steps. That the first thing you have to do is set up your protection. Then you want to pull in positive spirits. So that would be the second step. And then the third step is the herbs that you would use to actually communicate. But there's other ways to protect yourself. And if you're really interested in all these things, you should get the book, because the book goes into a lot of detail and gives you the spiritual and magical properties of the plants, but it also goes into the medicine for your body, and I have lots of cautions in there.
Yes.
You know, when not to take it if you're diabetic, if you're pregnant, if you have high blood pressure, you know, whatever like that. I'm very careful. But two other very protective plants are elder and wormwood. And you don't have to make a tea and drink it necessarily. You can make a wreath, or you can wear them as a crown. You can hang a wreath on the door. You could hang a wreath on a gatepost. In Europe, you know, back in the old days, they would make a wreath of elder and wormwood and wrap it around the milk pail. And that was to stop the fairies from stealing the milk, or the bad witches. There's bad witches and there's good witches. But, you know, if you didn't want the witches to steal your milk, that's what you would do. There's another really powerful herb called fumitory, which is really good for strep throat, by the way, as a tincture. But you could burn that. You can use it as a wash. You can wash yourself. You can put it in the bath. You can wash your floors. You can actually make a strong tea, put it in a bucket, get a mop, and wash your floors. You can also put it in the ritual fire. Just sprinkle it in there. Another very traditional combination, this is from Europe again, you make a wreath out of sweet woodruff, bramble, which is... like anything with thorns, blackberry, raspberry, rowan, which is mountain ash, and then you bind it, you wrap it with ivy. That's how you hold the wreath together. And then that would be another one that you could put on the door. You could hang it on the wall. You could hang it from the gatepost. A very classic herb that was used in
might. Yeah, it's possible.
Okay. Well, it's an evergreen in Scotland at Hogmanay, which is New Year's. It's very traditional to burn juniper in the fireplace, and you fumigate the house, and you fill the whole house with juniper smoke, and then you open the windows and doors, and it drives out all the bad spirits, and you start the new year, you know. But it was also, like I said, it was used in France and Gaul, and you can also make a necklace of juniper berries, or rowan, mountain ash berries. That's extremely protective. That's rowan was used in the highlands of Scotland. The women would wear a necklace of the berries, and that was protection. And then nettles. You must have nettles. Do you have nettles?
Everybody. I think so.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, you know,
sounds like we're so bereft of everything. Yeah.
But you know what it's like to walk into a bunch of nettles, right? It's going to sting you.
Yep.
So it has the same effect on the spirit world. And you can hang bunches of nettles on your door, on gateposts. They used to stick them under the eaves of the house, you know, and that would repel nasty spirits. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, there's lots of... And these are all discussed at great length in the book. This is an old Highland thing. You make a little equal-armed cross out of rowan, mountain ash twig. It's not the Latin cross. It's not the Christian cross. It's a solar cross. It's equal-armed, bound with red thread. You can hang that on the wall. You can wear it. You can hide it under your clothing. That's considered very protective. And then... St. John's wort.
Yeah.
You probably have St. John's wort, I'm sure. And you can drink the tea. You can hang it around the house. You can sprinkle the tea around the house. You can tie it to doorknobs. You can also put sea salt into the tea when you sprinkle it around. And I know you have sea salt.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have seas.
Yes, you have seawater. See, I live in the woods, in the mountains. I don't have that. But I have people that bring it to me from the coast. But seawater, just plain old seawater, you know, a white candle and a bowl of seawater is incredibly powerful.
It is.
You know, you just go from corner to corner, illuminate the corners with the candle and sprinkle the seawater, and that'll do it.
You know, it was funny because you mentioned wreaths, because I was going to ask you about that. So we took care of that. But when I was writing up some notes and stuff, all of a sudden I was thinking, well, okay, what could people put together for the wreath? And you've already said that. But then I was also thinking that maybe some herbs are not compatible with others. I mean, would they kind of clash or cancel each other's out if they were bundled together?
Well, everything that I just mentioned, this is the way my brain works, okay? Everything I mentioned, this is all from tradition. And that's what I'm most interested in. I'm a Celtic Reconstructionist Druid, and we're CR Druid. as Celtic Reconstructionists, what we like to do, what really turns us on, is to find the old ways and bring them back. And try to practice them. So everything I just mentioned to you is something that was done for thousands of years. I mean, the Iron Age was 2,000 years ago, you know. So, I mean, these practices maybe are even older than that, you know. But but that's what's in the book. You know, I give only traditional herbs, and I talk about the way they've been traditionally used. And I talk about exactly which culture they come from, you know, whether it comes from Greece or Britain or Ireland, or, you know, I'm very careful that way. And, so everything that I just mentioned. Now, yeah, putting things together, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to put belladonna, for example, with marshmallow root. I'm sorry, if you're a herbalist, that's hilarious.
No, it's funny to me too. Yeah, and I'm not a herbalist, but it's funny.
Yeah, because marshmallow root pulls in really sweet, gentle, kind, friendly spirits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then belladonna is kind of badass. Pardon my French, but
they'd have to duke it out, which that would be kind of amusing.
Yeah, it would be. Just wouldn't do that.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break in about 2 minutes. And so everybody sit tight, and we'll be right back.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Just in time for Halloween. Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The deck can also be used in conjunction with Tarot, the Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at marlabrooks.com and is now available for pre-ordering from shifferbooks.com and amazon.com.
This is New Aeon Now. News and discussion of the metaphysical, the occult, the paranormal, and much, much more. With your hosts, New Aeon High Priestess Reverend Lily Alley, head of the Draken Chapter of the Order of Paranormal Exploration, Christine Matza. The New Aeon is now. Join us every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for New Aeon Now.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And we are back, like he said, and my guest is Ellen Everett Hopman, and we're talking about her latest and very timely book, The Sacred Herbs of Samhain. Now, the book covers so many things. The identification, harvest, and use of more than 70 plants and trees for healing, divination, purification, magic, and as tools for contacting the spirits. But I want to get back to protection for just a minute, because you mentioned, and it makes good sense, that protection is not just from spirits or entities, but it's also protection from living beings, Not everybody is sane. Let's talk a little bit about herbal protection in this realm in general. And specifically, maybe I want you to tell the story about your Midsummer's Eve vigil high on that hill, which is a very good example of plants offering us protection from others.
Well, that was scary. I like to, in the summer when I can, I like to do an all-night vigil. And, like on the summer solstice, that's a nice time to do it. It's also the shortest night, so that makes it a good time to do that. But anyway, so I was dressed in a dark cape with a big hood. It was a navy blue cloak. And I had a basket with me, and I had a rattle, and I had a spray of oak. And for Druids, that's extremely traditional. Mm-hmm. We have very few descriptions of actual ancient Druid ceremonies, but some of the people that were describing the ceremony said that they would not do a ceremony without the oak, without a branch of oak. So I always have, I live in an oak forest, so I don't have to worry about it because I'm surrounded by oak trees. But if I'm traveling and I don't know if there's going to be an oak tree, then I have to take a branch of oak with me. So that's what I had in the basket. An old traditional European thing was to make an equal-armed cross. You could make it out of oak and wear that as protection. But anyway, so I had a branch, and it was a full moon night, and I was out there, and I'm minding my own business, and all of a sudden this gang of really drunk college boys came up the hill, and they were yelling, and they were obviously drunk. They were stumbling around and very incoherent, and all of a sudden they saw me, and they started going, "The witch, that's a witch, get the witch." I'm not a witch, I'm a druid, but hey. So they just kept saying, "Kill the witch, get the witch." And, that was pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I was clutching the oak, and I just dropped to the ground. I pulled the hood over my head and dropped. And at that night, I understood why witches wear black. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a very good thing to do if you're out at night, is to wear black, because if you have to disappear, you can disappear. Because I just dropped to the ground, and they kept circling around yelling, "Where's the witch? Get the witch!" And they couldn't find me. I had literally disappeared. And they gave up, and they went back down the hill. And I don't know what would have happened if they had found me, but I don't think it would have been good.
No.
I felt I was protected. And
yeah, people are worse than spirits, honestly. Living souls can be a lot scarier and a lot more dangerous. Just a question from the chat room came in, and he wanted to know, are the herbs we use at Samhain for protection different than the ones that we would use any other time of the year for protection?
No, I don't think so. Herbs of protection are herbs of protection.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's going to be really hard to find juniper berries or rowan berries at Beltane, unless you have them saved from last year. St. John's wort, you're not going to really find until midsummer. At least in my area. I don't know what goes on in your area.
All kinds of things go on.
Yeah, so nettles at Beltane probably would only be a couple of inches tall. So by Samhain, they're nice. They're like 3 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Poplar buds would be available in the spring. Pine resin would be available in the spring. Rosemary would probably be around.
Mm-hmm.
So you work with what's available. You work with what you have.
Yeah, seasonal. That makes sense. Sometimes mm-hmm. you got it, and sometimes you wait. But depending on how you use them in whatever form, it doesn't exactly matter what they are. It's the intention you're putting into them, and they're certain protective properties. So, they're abundant all over the place. I mean, people never have to worry about not being able to find something for protection.
Right. I mean, yes. Do you have sage growing where you are?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. So sage, that's a classic one. Some people get nervous about using it because they feel like it's cultural appropriation, sage. But, in Europe, they used kitchen sage.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't use white sage. They didn't have white sage, but they certainly had regular kitchen sage.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have that, you can use that. But again, at Beltane, that's not going to be very tall, but by Samhain, it should be, very usable.
Yeah.
So, I would just say go with what you have in your area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right, so people ask a lot about offerings, and you've got some really great information on that in the book, but I think the sweetest offering that you mentioned, and it really made me smile, was when you were at a ritual, and as well as people leaving out offerings for the ancestors, there was also a plate of tuna set out for the deceased familiars. And that really touched my heart. That was really very, very cool. And I think people might not think about that. But, yeah, that was nice. Just mentioning. So if someone is setting up an ancestor altar for the first time, getting to offerings, what types of offerings and botanicals would you suggest? Just kind of like the basic starter kit, maybe?
Okay, well, as I mentioned, you know, there's the three steps. You want to have herbs of protection, you want to have herbs to attract gentle spirits, and then you want to have herbs to communicate with the ancestors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just because somebody's dead doesn't mean that they're smart, and it also doesn't mean that they're nice. Mm-hmm. So if you have an ancestor altar, you don't want to be working with your aunt who's still mad at you or something, you know. You want to be working with your great-great-great-great-grandmother who was a herbalist and a healer and who really would like to communicate what she knows to you because, you know, she knows that you would appreciate it. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, as I mentioned, marshmallow is a really nice one. You can put marshmallow, the plant, or the root, or the leaves, or the flowers on the altar. And that's actually from hoodoo tradition. But marshmallow is a demulcent. It's very soothing to the mucus linings of the body. And it does the same thing in the spirit world. It's very soothing. So the spirits that will be attracted to it are the gentle, soothing, nice ones, okay? Angelica root is another interesting one. It pulls in angelic forces. Mm-hmm. You know, it depends on if you think your ancestors were angels, I guess. But it's called Angelica Archangelica because it pulls in archangelic energies. Mm. There's marjoram. That's a Greek thing. The Greeks used to plant it on graves, but it allays grief and it brings peace. So if you say you have an ancestor or a relative who died in some kind of traumatic fashion, and you want to work with them, you could use the herb marjoram. There's lots of, you know, plants that bring peace. Pine is another one. But marjoram is a classic Greek herb to dispel grief and help the dead to find peace. But fir, pine, white cedar, any of those kinds of aromatic conifers, you burn them as incense, a natural forest incense, or you wear the oil and you put the branches on the altar, and that's going to attract peaceful energies. Mm-hmm. In the Egyptian tradition, there's myrrh, you can burn, and it was the favorite herb of Isis, the goddess Isis, and it's actually a resin, but it helps with meditation and helps to calm the mind.
Yes, it does.
So those are just some examples.
Okay. Along those lines, there's another question from the chat room. Is there a big difference in using dry herbs as opposed to fresh herbs, or will that depend on what they're being used for?
Well, yeah, it depends, because if you're offering something to the fire or if you want to burn it as incense, there are some green herbs like cedar, for example, you can burn it. And pine, you could burn it when it's green. But most plants you don't want to burn when they're green. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're burning sage, for example, you want dry sage. You don't want moist sage, you know. you just need to figure out what you're working with. Some things are more appropriate as a tea. If you only have the fresh herb, you're not going to burn it. You're probably going to make a tea, or you're going to decorate the altar with it or make a wreath out of it, something like that. If you have the dried herbs, then you can burn them on the altar, especially if they're aromatic and they have scent. You know, that's a really nice thing to do.
Yeah, because I've known people who just get pine needles and just, you know, put them in a flame-proof thing and just burn those, and it's automatic incense and right. really nice. Yeah, I think people sometimes, I do too, I think I make things harder than they should be by not just noticing the obvious and just, yeah, okay, well, no, I don't have pine incense. Well, no, go get some pines. You can do that. It works really well. Now, you also, I mean, you have some wonderful things in the book, like recipes, and some were quite wonderful and enlightening and not at all run-of-the-mill. And, I mean, you have things like rowanberry jam, sage and onion dumplings, candied wild violets, and, I'm pronouncing it maybe wrong, barmbrack, the Irish raisin bread.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's kind of where divination and cookery go hand in hand, because it's like those Mardi Gras breads in New Orleans where they put little tokens in there, you know, and stuff. And this is kind of the same way, but little tokens are hidden inside the bread, like a coin would mean wealth, or a ring means marriage, or a shred of cloth or a bean means poverty. Hope you don't get that. And the tokens are endless, but it really is a nice kind of divination idea, and it's probably delicious. Also, you just have to warn everybody about the choking hazard, right?
Yeah, and make sure that you're not giving it to little kids.
Yeah.
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 But like I said, all the things that are in there, they're all traditional. Barmbrack is a very traditional dish. Goes back many centuries, you know. So, I mean, that's what I like to do. I like to find the real stuff, the real deal. The rowanberry jam, for example, in Scotland, in the Highlands, up until maybe a couple hundred years ago, they had no real medicine other than rowanberries, maybe some garlic, maybe, you know, they had herbs, they knew about herbs, but they didn't have antibiotics, they certainly didn't have vitamin pills, they didn't know what vitamin C was, you know, none of that. The rowanberries, after the first frost, when they turn bright red, they actually have more vitamin C than lemons.
Mm.
And what they would do is they would make a syrup. Now, they, you know, they were making this syrup, and they weren't sitting there thinking, oh, this has lots of vitamin C. It will cure your cold. That's not what they were thinking. They were thinking, oh, rowanberries, they're red. They're magical. They're very protective. The first rowan tree came from the land of fairy. It's a magical plant. Let's make a syrup, you know. So they would take the berries, and they would slice up apples. You know, apples are available in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the berries and honey and apples, and you make a syrup out of that. And if somebody has bronchitis or pneumonia or the flu or whatever, you give them the syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And all they know is it works. They don't know it has vitamin C, but they know it works, you know. And then the jam was something, you know, one of the deadliest conditions around the world as far as kids. The thing that probably kills more babies than anything is diarrhea, just plain old diarrhea. So in third world countries, you know, when all they have is polluted water, it's like absolutely deadly. So they would make the jam, and again, the jam is made with apples and honey and the berries, and it's anti-diarrheal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can give it to children, you can give it to babies, adults, whatever.
You know, with nature, and hundreds of years ago, that's all we relied on for remedies, and they worked. And it always kind of boggles my mind that somewhere along the line, somebody said, oh, let's make synthetic medicines. Let's do that. Where did that come from? I mean, it's kind of a bonehead thing to do because, you know, they don't have all the side effects that pharmaceuticals have. I mean, I'm not saying they're bad, but boy, we have such an abundant bunch of things that we can use that would just be nature-oriented.
Well, the reason that they made the synthetic medicines, I mean, I can do a whole lecture on that. First of all, that's how you make money.
Well, yeah.
Because you can patent the quote-unquote active principle. You can't patent a plant, usually. If everybody's growing the plant and everybody can find it for free in their backyard, like redwood trees, for example, the mm-hmm. Indians used the California Indians used redwood as a skin healer. Mm-hmm. You can't patent a redwood, but you could find the active principle in redwood trees, and you could patent that and then make money on it. Mm-hmm. But the actual story, what happened was when people made the transition from farming, most people were farmers for the last 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And when you're a farmer, you're in business for yourself. You get up when you get up. You go to bed when you go to bed. You don't have an alarm clock, or back in the day they didn't. There were no alarm clocks. You probably got up when your chickens started yelling at you. But, but you know, if you didn't want to work on a particular day, you didn't, you know, or you were free. You were your own boss, right? Mm-hmm. So along comes the factory system. And this had never existed before in human history, except maybe in tiny little, you know, shops here and there, but most people were farmers. So now they had to be regimented, which meant that every single day they had to get up at the exact same time, and never in human history had that ever been true, which meant they had to go to bed at the exact same time in order to get enough sleep to get up at the exact same time. And no matter how they were feeling, if they were injured, if they were tired, they had to keep working. Because if they didn't show up for work the next day, they'd be fired.
Right.
So this is a completely different existence. So what happened was the Bayer company, you know, Bayer Aspirin,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
They knew, people used willow bark. Willow bark was the remedy that for headaches and fevers and, you know, sprains and muscle aches and things like that. So Bayer figured out the active principle, salicylic acid. They made the first synthetic medicine, which was aspirin, and they made that so that the people working in the factories, if they got injured, would keep working. So then they said, okay, people need to get up at the same time every day. How are we going to make sure they get up? So they invented cocaine, which was to make people get up and be ready to work immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And that was put into drinks. You know, it used to be in Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
It was, you know, so that was made to wake you up. Then they needed something to put you to sleep. Because never in human history had people been expected to go to bed at exactly the same time every night, you know, regimented. It just, that didn't exist. So they invented heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the first synthetic drugs. And it was all done to keep the factory workers going.
Yeah. Yeah, sad but true. I mean, but yeah, we could talk about that for a long time. Let me talk a little bit more about the book, because between the recipes, the rituals, the lore and traditions of Samhain, this really is a must-have book. I mean, there's more in it that I haven't mentioned, like or we haven't talked about, like indexes of plants, both by scientific and common names, offering for the fairies for each Sabbat, a sample Samhain rite, and way more. It's
dumb
just
supper.
The dumb supper. Yes, absolutely. We have like 3 minutes to talk about a dumb supper, because I was going to bring that up. I mean, some of us know. Tell everybody else what a dumb supper is.
Okay, well, that's another big subject, because the earliest reference that we could find for the Dumb Supper was about 1640, something like that. We couldn't find any earlier reference to that. So it doesn't seem to be a really ancient practice, but basically it's a silent meal, dumb as in silent.
Mm-hmm.
And I give instructions in the book, and I give recipes, you know, suggested foods, how to set the table. Basically, you set a place, you have an empty chair at the table, you put food there, that chair is for the spirits. Mm-hmm. And you can have candles in jars for whichever ancestors you're honoring. You can have little messages for them, which you leave by the candles. Everybody else eats in silence. The host serves everything. There's no talking throughout the meal. And I've thought about it a lot, like, where, how come there's no references to this that are older than, you know, 1640 or so? Mm-hmm. And I've thought about it. Back in ancient Celtic times, people fed the ancestors all the time. Mm-hmm. Every time you had a ritual, you always gave food to the ancestors. You know, and every time there was a big holiday like Samhain, Imbolc, Beltane, Lunasa, whatever, you always put out food for the fairies and the ancestors, because the fairies and the ancestors live in the same realm. Mm-hmm. You also put out food for the gods and goddesses. So I think that this is kind of a Christian era memory, which is done once a year, but back in the day, we did it all the time, mm-hmm. you know.
Commonly.
That's what I think is going on here. I think it's a folk memory of the old religion and the way we used to feed the ancestors.
Mm. It sounds nice. And if anybody, you know, really get the book, read the book. There's so much stuff in there. Have a dumb supper. It's not too late to plan it for now. But the other thing that we want to talk about is where people can find you on a website or your books or all that good stuff before we run out of time.
Well, yeah, if you want to, you can see all my books. I have a blog. I list all my workshops at ellenevertthopman.com, ellenevertthopman.com. And then if you're interested in Druid studies and you want to go more deeply into all of this, visit tribeoftheoak.com. It's all one word, tribeoftheoak.com. We have a teaching grove. We have people studying towards initiation. They usually take around 3 years. Some people take longer to do the training. We have one-on-one, we call it fostership. There's a lot of reading involved, so you have to be somewhat intellectual, because Druids were always intellectuals. We still are. We do have one-on-one mentorship. We call it fostership at tribeoftheoak.com. And we have members all over the world now. We have all across the United States, Ireland, and South Africa, and Mexico.
Oh,
that's
nice.
What we have right now, yeah.
Great. And there's always room for more.
Yep.
Well, thank you. I can't wait till I get to bug you again in the spring about the Beltane book to have you back. But in the meantime, I wasn't kidding when I tell everybody it's a really good book to have, really, really good, full of information, you know. So do that. And so again, thank you for joining me tonight. And thank everybody in the chat room as well and those that are listening on podcast. And I'm thinking we got to get out of here. So until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2019. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompotech.com.